Okay, so let's get started with this third lecture of four. I'll start with a summary of what we covered so far, just to remind ourselves of the picture which I've been trying to build up, is that the Sanner model is an effective field theory, and to try and really ingrain this picture of effective field theory in your minds. And the shortcomings of the Sanner model viewed in light of three different categories for how we can judge the seriousness of these different problems. The aesthetic problems are things like the Yukawas, varying over six orders of magnitude for no reason. The flavor structure, which is also related to the Yukawa couplings, is something which doesn't have any explanation and yet exhibits some kind of structure. The hypercharges, you could say, is another type of hint that there is some kind of structure in the Sanner model, in the sense that there is no reason why a U1 charge has to be quantized in units of 1/6, as we find in the Sanner model. So this could be indicative of something that is not necessary, but aesthetically would be pleasing to have the forces unify as well. In the same way that the electroweak force unifies, it would be nice to have something like a grand unified theory which unifies the SU3, SU2, and U1 together at high scales. So some of these are more, let's say, wishful thinking, but at the same time, if you look at the Sanner model particle content, then they do seem to fit very nicely into multiplets of some SU5 or SO10 groups, including neutrino masses. So this is something which didn't have to be that way, and the fact that all the anomalies cancel in the Sanner model is also something that didn't have to be that way when you go out and experimentally find out what degrees of freedom exist. They didn't have to come in such complete multiplets and in ways that cancel anomalies. So if you haven't heard about anomaly cancellation, I won't have time to go into that. But that's a non-trivial consistency check on the kind of global symmetries that you're allowed to gauge. You should read the paper of Georgi and Glashow on SU5 unification as an example of something that's is written in a way that makes it seem almost like it's too good to be true. And when you read that paper, you're really convinced that this really has to be the case. But at the same time, the proton decay experiments have shown that the minimal realizations of guts in SU5 are already excluded. But this is not to say that there's not other ways of doing guts. And we'll see that to do gut model building requires extra degrees of freedom as well, in the sense that if you take the coupling strength in the Sanner model and you take the scale at which you run these couplings down from our scale up to, say, up to the Planck scale, you hope they unify before that, then we take the U1 hypercharge, the SU2 field strength, and the SU3 color strength, then we find that this is inverse alpha. So the U1 gets stronger as you go to higher scales. SU2 and SU3 get weaker. And you find that in the Sanner model, they do something like this, where this scale is somewhere around 10 to the 14 GeV. Okay, so this is in GeV. And this is in the Sanner model. Okay, it's no surprise that two lines would meet at some scale, but it is non-trivial if three lines actually meet somewhere, but this is not the case for the Sanner model. So the grand unified theory was a nice idea that required some extra degrees of freedom to modify the running of these couplings beyond the Sanner model in order for the forces to actually unify. But you could say this is part of the categorization of aesthetic hints for structure beyond the standard model. But there's nothing wrong with the standard model in itself. There's nothing inconsistent. And in as much as they don't look natural, it wouldn't be unnatural in the more technical sense of cancellations of completely independent things, which is a more serious problem. This was what I mentioned briefly in terms of the strong CP problem. Okay, I mentioned that the missing term in the standard model Lagrangian is something that looks strange from the point of view of EFT, where every term is there except for one, and the coefficient has to be extremely small. So you could say that this would have been in this category had it not been for the fact that you have different contributions that are independent and that cancel, that place it more in this kind of second category. The cosmological constant and the Higgs mass are also those kind of cancellations that we don't understand based on the symmetry structure of the standard model Lagrangian. Okay, I won't talk about the things that we can't ignore, the inconsistencies that could be either experimental or theoretical. Okay, so we've had lots of talks already on dark matter by Nick, so he did an excellent job in giving a survey of dark sectors in our universe, which you could argue is also part of an aesthetic motivation in the sense that we already know that there are dark sectors in the universe. We have to have dark matter. We have to have right-handed neutrinos or something that generates neutrino masses. And just like our visible sector is not minimal, there are multiplicities of generations for no reason. There's no similar argument for why the dark sector itself has to be just one particle that does what we need it to do and nothing else. So there's all kinds of motivations for light new physics and heavy physics and all kinds of dark sectors such as dark photons and so on. And indeed, one of the types of BSM model building that people try to do to explain, for example, the stochastic gravitational wave background that is due to be announced tomorrow is precisely some dark sector that confines at around the MeV scale. But this has lots of other constraints which may or may not be excluded. So dark matter is a big problem that tells us there is something there. And I think you've already heard about the WIMP miracle. Okay, so I'll just reiterate here what that was about. Okay, the freeze-out mechanism that we know sets the relic density of everything else we see in our universe, and neutrinos and protons and neutrons and so on. So that kind of mechanism would very minimally be applied to some new neutrino-like particle that is just a bit heavier. And it just so happens that if this particle happens to have a weak scale mass interacting through the weak force, then its mass would be around the weak scale. So this is, maybe miracle is too strong a word, but it is something that doesn't look, that just pops out in some ways in a natural way. Okay, in the same sense that we didn't have to do anything to put the standard model representations in a complete gut multiplet, it's nice that just adding a new weakly interacting particle just happens to have the right properties to freeze out and give the right relic density. And the theoretical inconsistencies I mentioned are things like the black hole information paradox and quantizing gravity and things that require our theory to actually be a fundamental theory should be sensible at all scales and be finite. Okay, now I also try to contrast the arbitrariness of the Higgs to something that isn't arbitrary at all. It's almost the opposite of an arbitrary theory in how satisfying it is in its predictiveness and its range of phenomena that just pop out without having to put in anything by hand. And those are non-abelian gauge theories. Okay, so the problem of finding a more satisfying underlying explanation for the Higgs is independent from the naturalness problem of the Higgs mass. We expect it to come from a more fundamental theory, regardless. And in that theory, the Higgs mass should be calculable, or the potential, more generally, should be calculable. And this is where the examples we went through of where a calculable Higgs mass is fine-tuned, the more you take the heavy scale that generates the Higgs potential to be heavier. We saw that in concrete models, this is a tuning that you can't ignore. You're putting in the parameters by hand again to get a light Higgs as you decouple the sector. So unlike all these other problems that can be solved at very high scales, they could be at accessible scales, we don't know, but there's no argument why they have to be close to the weak scale. This fine-tuning argument is the only one that we have, together with the WIMP argument for dark matter, for new physics at the weak scale. This is why there was much excitement about discovering the solution to the Higgs naturalness problem when the LHC switched on, and even before the LHC at the Tevatron and at LEP, because these arguments would have led us to expect that these solutions would have appeared together with the Higgs. And after these concrete models, we showed how this is a general argument based on symmetry for why radiative corrections destabilize the Higgs. Okay, more generally, from this EFT point of view, symmetry is what controls the structure of an EFT. Okay, so let me remind you of this concept of technical naturalness, where if we take a toy model of a complex scalar that contains in its Lagrangian only these terms, we have a Weyl fermion, and we have just a scalar with a mass term, m squared phi squared, and a mass term for the fermion, and some interaction terms. Then remember that as you take a parameter to zero, if you have an enhanced symmetry, you understand why that parameter is naturally small, because the only thing that violates that symmetry would be if the radiative corrections break a symmetry, it has to go through the parameter that breaks that symmetry. When that parameter is zero, the symmetry is there, so there's nothing in the theory that can break that. So let's take some examples where we take, in this Lagrangian, the phi mass to zero. Then we see that a shift symmetry is restored for the phi. Where if the interaction terms respect this shift symmetry, then the only parameter that can violate this is the mass term. And so we can understand why m phi is small. And this is the way in which composite Higgs models try to naturalize the Higgs, which we'll see tomorrow. We can also take in this toy model the fermion mass to zero, and in this case we have a chiral symmetry of the left and right components of the fermion. Which leads to understanding why fermion masses are small. Yep.
What happens if that M phi is zero, so we have this shift symmetry, but can we break it with loop corrections?
So this is exactly the argument of why loop corrections can't break the symmetry, or, well, why loop corrections have to break the symmetry proportional to the parameter, because it's the only thing that breaks the symmetry in your theory. Okay, so imagine if a loop correction broke this symmetry in a way that wasn't proportional to this parameter, then it would make no sense as you take this parameter to zero and your symmetry is restored in the Lagrangian. But if that symmetry is restored in your theory, then how can a loop correction or any kind of calculation in that theory break that symmetry? Okay. So this is why Te Hooft came up with this technical naturalness argument for understanding when parameters can be small in this totalitarian sense that quantum mechanical corrections will do everything it can, but they have to respect the symmetries in your theory.
So they can be proportional to these M5.
Exactly, yeah.
From a purely pedantic historical perspective, I would call that Tuft naturalness, because it's the symmetry, the symmetry criterion is sufficient for the broader category of things, which is what I would call technical naturalness, where I define technical naturalness to be if a small parameter is small at some high scale,
it remains small. Yeah.
Tuft naturalness is sufficient for that, but it's not equivalent to that.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah.
There's a couple of examples.
So for Swan CP, for example, it could be natural, technically natural, without being a Tuft technically natural. So yes, there's
also these supernatural models, and so
right.
It's true that the symmetry is, it almost always, that's what you're looking for, is the
yeah. Yeah, so I always use a Tuft technical naturalness and technical naturalness sort of interchangeably, but there's a subtle distinction there. Yeah, that's true. That reminds me, actually, I was going to put a literature reference to Nathaniel Craig's excellent survey on this recent snow mass survey on naturalness, which I highly recommend reading. But I'll put this up at the end when I find the reference. So yeah, there's all kinds of distinctions which I'm sort of glossing over. And there's many examples I didn't mention as well in the past. I only mentioned the pion example, okay, but I didn't mention other examples like the GIM mechanism, for example, which predicted the charm quark mass based on these arguments. And retrospectively, they also lead us to expect when antiparticles might appear, for example, in understanding the self-energy of corrections of electromagnetism in their contribution to the mass of the electron. So there's many different examples where this argument makes sense, and it's not a wishy-washy notion, but is quite sharp and well-defined. Which makes the fact that they fail for the Higgs all the more puzzling in comparison. Okay, so I won't talk about scale symmetry, in that there's another symmetry which you can have if you take both masses to zero in that toy Lagrangian. Okay, but in this case, it's broken by quantum corrections, and the running of your couplings violates scale symmetry anyway. So I'll put this in brackets. And the final symmetry that you could have when you take the parameters to be equal is the topic of today, and that's supersymmetry. Okay, so if the interaction terms respects the supersymmetry in the sense that when you set these parameters to be equal, you have an enhanced symmetry in this part of the Lagrangian. If the interaction term respects that too, then there is nothing in your theory that violates this supersymmetry, And so any quantum corrections will also have to respect that. And so the masses of scalars are in some sense stabilized by being related to the masses of fermions.
The scale symmetry would be a kind of specific supersymmetry. Both are equal to zero.
Well, you could, yeah. I mean, it depends on your interaction term, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so this is sort of, let's say, the 1980s state of physics, in the sense that all of these problems were beginning to be appreciated. The standard models and effective field theory was beginning to be understood, and supersymmetry was being discovered. And the dark matter problem was starting to be appreciated in terms of ways of looking for WIMPs and the excitement of the time was in all of these things coming together: grand unification, supersymmetry, WIMPs, and so on, and naturalness, all in terms of something that, in some sense, just popped out. Okay, there's many ways of motivating this. You know, the reason why in the first lecture I gave different arguments for how you went from Fermi theory to the standard model was to emphasize that there's lots of different angles in which one can derive similar results with different motivations, whether it's finiteness of a theory starting with the amplitudes or trying to generalize the Lie algebra from abelian to non-abelian, or in this case, space-time symmetries. Let me start with the usual way in which supersymmetry is motivated, is that historically, the success of Gell-Mann's SU3 in classifying the particles and relating them together, and the excitement of using symmetries to relate particles led people to try and relate the force particles and the matter particles together in one big multiplet. Okay, so let's say that people were trying to unify the symmetries of bosons and fermions in a single multiplet. Now, this immediately led to a no-go theorem, the famous Coleman-Mandula theorem. And this said that it's essentially impossible to do this. Okay, so this no-go theorem essentially says that such a symmetry that relates fermions and bosons wouldn't commute with your Lorentz symmetry. So they can't commute. With your Lorentz symmetry, your internal symmetries have to be Lorentz scalars. But the way out of this no-go theorem is that this applies to bosonic generators. Okay, so your internal symmetries and your space-time symmetries can't go together unless you evade this no-go theorem Let me try and spell his name properly. Hag Lopuzansky Solius. In 1975, they show that the unique way out of this is to have fermionic generators. So the only way in which you could try and unify your internal symmetries and space-time symmetries is by extending your Lie algebra space-time symmetries with some fermionic generators that you can think of as a generalization of your Lie algebra. Okay, and I think there's a nice also argument by Witten where he shows that this is also impossible from the point of view of extending your space-time symmetries with additional bosonic generators would then trivialize your scattering matrix. So let me remind you that the Poincaré algebra consists of the generators of translation, boosts and rotations, okay, I think I won't write out the full thing here, but essentially you can think of it as taking this algebra and then saying that if you have internal symmetries generated by some generator B, then this is already the generalization from abelian to non-abelian, and then trying to find a way of including something that non-trivially mixes space-time and the internal generators is trying to go beyond having Lorentz scalars as your generators. So we add to this a fermionic generator. Okay, where these alpha are now spinorial indices. So we have a two-component spinner as a generator. And this leads to extra terms in your Lie algebra in which the generators now anti-commute. And in general, you could have more than one supersymmetric generator. Okay, so this is what you heard about in terms of n equals 4 supersymmetry. For Fermilogy, we typically consider n equals 1 supersymmetry. So the number of supersymmetric generators depends on the kind of theory you're interested in. But the more supersymmetry you have, obviously the more constraints you have, so your theory becomes easier to calculate, and in some ways this makes it also a nice formal playground for calculating results under controllable situations. So purely as a formal tool, it's also a very useful framework. And indeed, I was just in the Perimeter Library yesterday, picked up a random book, which was Feynman's Collected Works, and the first thing it opened on was a 1954 paper where he's calculating, I think, loop corrections in gravity at a time when no one was doing these things, and he was trying to understand, you know, the quantum field theory of a spin two particle. And he found that, you know, the analogy with another mathematical theory that was not necessarily a realistic one, but was useful as a calculational tool, was Yang-Mills theory. And he found that he could use methods from Yang-Mills theory to calculate in his spin two loop corrections. So, you know, I really think the analogy between supersymmetry and Yang-Mills theory is almost one-to-one in the sense that they were both considered nice mathematical generalizations. They both seem to be immediately excluded by nature unless you add something else to it. Except we haven't discovered supersymmetry, so it's not quite the same. But the analogy would be like if you didn't find the W and Z boson at 80 GeV or 90 GeV, you didn't find them at 100 GeV, now you're starting to get a bit uncomfortable. But at the same time, you know, the framework is quite compelling. Okay, so this is just to, oops, this should be commuting. Okay, I'm not going to write down all the terms, but this algebra is enough to then deduce the representations of your field content in order to satisfy this algebra. Okay, this is normally like the first few lectures of a course on supersymmetry, so I won't actually go through the details of how you go from this algebra to building up the representations. Okay, you can use a trick where you extend your space-time coordinates with some coordinates that are anti-commuting Grassmann numbers. Okay, so this is a trick that makes it easier to construct. Okay, so you can extend space-time with two more coordinates that are anti-commuting numbers. And using this superspace trick, you can write your multiplets in terms of the superspace. But you don't have to do that, okay? You can also just take the Lie algebra and construct the representations by brute force in a way. So let's say that you have a chiral supermultiplet, they're usually called chiral supermultiplets, that include a scalar and a fermion in them. And your vector supermultiplets would relate a vector field to a fermionic field. Okay, well, I won't write equals because this would essentially be a superfield that you write in terms of an expansion in these extra Grassmann coordinates. But the main thing is just that you have these supermultiplets that relate fermions to bosons. Okay, let me use B for the vector bosons. The typical names are sfermions for the scalar superpartner of the fermion, and gauginos for the fermionic partner of the gauge bosons.
I suppose the essence fermion is kind of like scalar, but is there a reason for gauginos?
I think it was Italians who came up with that name. I don't know. But this is why you hear things like hexino, neutralino, and so on. Okay. Okay. So the Lagrangian, which I'll just write down, okay, maybe just to give you a sense of how this superspace can help you with writing down supersymmetric Lagrangians, but is not necessary, is that these super multiplets, okay, the phis and the v's are written in terms of these Grassmann coordinates. And in the superspace formalism, you can write basically a shorthand for something that, when you expand, gives you the supersymmetric Lagrangian. Okay. Nope, d for theta. So that's actually the Grassmann coordinates, which, because they're anti-commuting, the integral d theta d theta is 1. Okay, if you have theta squared, it equals 0 if they're identical. Okay, so
if you combine the theta and theta bar into one measure, because it's two dimensions.
Yes, those are actually two. D2 theta bar, yeah. So I'm just writing this sort of schematically to give you, let's say, a picture rather than actual, you know, derivations. Because...
Should the first be an x, d for x?
In this?
Yeah.
No, this is, so this is the super, this is the superspace, way of writing down the Lagrangian that when you actually expand the superpotential, okay, this is why I wrote this, okay, because the full thing is actually an expression that expands in terms of the Grassmann coordinates, the things that actually depend on the field, okay. And in a sense, these pick out the relevant terms from that expansion in the supermultiplet, okay.
Why is one of them before theta and the other one is d2 theta?
Because they pick out different terms.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. So let me put this in bracket. I wasn't actually going to mention this because then it would take us too far into describing the superspace formalism. And I really want to emphasize that, you know, you don't have to do this at all. Okay. So once you expand that, you could have just gone directly to writing down your supersymmetric Lagrangian and constructing by hand your representations that satisfy the Lie algebra. And the result that you get is essentially all you need to really remember is that you have your scalar kinetic terms, you have your fermion kinetic terms, you have your gauge boson kinetic terms, which here we call B, and you have your Gugino kinetic terms, which are fermions. Okay, in the adjoint representation, since they are the supersymmetric partners of the gauge bosons. And then you just have to remember to add the terms that are required to be there by supersymmetry. Which are the fermion Gugino interactions. So you have a fermion Gugino. Sorry, this is the Gugino fermion. Sorry, this is the scalar Gugino interaction, and you also have the fermion Gugino interactions that come from taking the superpotential, taking a second derivative and then replacing it with the scalar field. Okay, this is the derivative with respect to the supermultiplet, and then you take the scalar terms in there and couple those to the fermions.
One of those phis should be a...
Sorry, this should be a psi, yes. Okay. So the scalar potential, yes, this is the fermion Gugino interaction. Fermion Gugino. Then the superpotential is where you get the terms involving only the scalars. Okay. So this would come from taking a derivative of the superpotential and then replacing it with the phi and terms that come Okay, let me just label this as the scalar potential, okay, for all these terms. These are the extra interactions that you get from the supersymmetric structure, in particular this fermion Gugino interactions, and the kinetic terms. Okay, so in some ways to supersymmetrize your theory, you just have to remember to add these interactions, and the scalar potential is now related to your gauge couplings. And so you have extra symmetries that now determine your scalar potential in terms of the gauge structure of your theory. And this is why you have a much more satisfying understanding of where the scalars can come from. And their properties are all calculable in a way that relates them to the gauge sector. Now, we know that supersymmetry is not exact, or we'd have discovered all the super partners together with the existing standard model content. So just like you need a mechanism to give masses to non-abelian gauge bosons, you also need a mechanism to break supersymmetry in some way. So these supersymmetry breaking terms are the things that we don't know what the underlying mechanism is. There's different ways to break supersymmetry, but they can be parameterized in a low energy theory by just adding explicit terms that violate the supersymmetry in a way that doesn't reintroduce a hierarchy problem. So we call them soft breaking terms. The minimal supersymmetrization of the standard model is what we call the MSSM. It's minimal in the sense that we just take the standard model content and we just supersymmetrize it. Okay, there's no reason why other than that's the first thing you would want to do. And this minimal extension already has a lot of nice properties that come essentially for free. One of the things that we talked about already was the quantum corrections to the Higgs mass are now tamed by the superpartners. Okay, but not just to the Higgs, but basically to all scalars.
So that's a property of MSSM.
Of supersymmetry.
Oh.
Yes. So just like in the example that we showed before, if you have a supersymmetry, then the masses of the fermions and the scalars are related. And if there is nothing that breaks that, then it has to be exact. And even if you break it with some breaking terms, as long as the corrections are small enough that you don't have a tuning between the different contributions, then you have a stable, you have an understanding of why the scalar fields are light. And as you make these corrections larger and larger, this is where we get into the uncomfortable regime of having to cancel. Okay, so remember the calculation that we did in the previous lecture was to do the loop corrections to the Higgs. We now have a superpartner to the top, which we call the stop, and we usually put a wavy line on top to indicate the superpartner. So the corrections that are quadratically sensitive to your heavy UV physics are now k cancelled exactly in the exact supersymmetric limit by the stop contribution, which has the opposite sign.
When does that calculation stop?
When does that calculation stop?
Stop, you know.
Stop. Nice pun. All right. Maybe you should name the next particles that appear. So the other success of the MSSM that you get for free is natural wind candidates. Okay.
What are those terms to be breaking?
Yeah, so you could write down just the mass term, for example, for the scalars without the corresponding term for the fermions, and that breaks the supersymmetry. Okay, so basically, think of any term you can write down that that you don't write down for the corresponding superpartners, and that would be a breaking of the supersymmetry. Okay, but if you read the literature, you'll find that they talk about soft breaking terms, and the difference between all the possible terms you can write down is that some of them would reintroduce a hierarchy problem, some wouldn't. Okay, so this is why you only want to write down the terms that are soft. So in some ways, this looks like it's not so appealing in the sense that, okay, now we have to put in the breaking by hand, and we only put in by hand the ones that are soft breaking. But it's, in a sense, a parameterization of our ignorance that if you do write down, and people, you know, that was a whole active area for a long time of trying to come up with SUSY breaking mechanisms and their phenomenological consequences, is that they then feed into what you expect for the low energy phenomenology, depending on how SUSY is broken. Okay. That's also in large part the reason why you have a proliferation of parameters that also give you a large parameter space for the phenomenology. Okay, so when people talk about the MSSM, they usually mean also with certain assumptions on how these parameters can be related in terms of smaller sets of parameters. But some of these assumptions are just there to make it more manageable. Okay, now people are considering the full set of parameters. They call this the PMSSM, the phenomenological MSSM, where you really allow all these unknown parameters to just vary, and then you look at the phenomenology. Okay, so, and then you could also add extra degrees of freedom. Okay. You could. There's no reason why you wouldn't add, say, you know, an axion. You could add some other scalar singlets. You could add some extra Higgs doublets. You could do whatever you like. Okay, so really, when we say supersymmetry, this is a framework. You know, the realizations, and just like in non-abelian gauge theory, you know, you could have SU2, SU3, SU4, SU5, or whatever gauge theories you want. And indeed, the first version of non-abelian gauge theories that Glashow wrote down was wrong. You know, so some. It often happens that the minimal first thing you want to do is not the right one. But the reason why you could imagine in the 80s people getting very excited, right, is that you have this beautiful generalization of your Lie algebra. The only way in which you can evade a no-go theorem unifies different aspects of nature, space-time symmetries, internal symmetries, scalars and fermions, you know, makes your scalars not arbitrary by relating them to the gauge sector. So everything is calculable. The potential is related to the gauge couplings. And it stabilizes your hierarchies. So you no longer have this naturalness problem. It gives you a Wimp candidate in terms of the neutral superpartners of the Higgs, the fermions. We call them Higgsinos. The neutral gauginos, okay, or neutralinos, as we call them. There would be linear combinations of them. Since they mix in the mass matrix, you have to diagonalize them, and depending on your parameters, they could be different. They could be different combinations. Okay, but essentially, these are exactly the weakly interacting neutral particles that are like the neutrinos, just heavier, and they just they are just part of your theory by necessity, by the supersymmetry. Okay, so. So to top that as well, again, this just pops out that if you now run your parameters, let me just draw it up here rather than doing it again. In the MSSM, the running is modified in a way that makes the SU2 actually decrease SU3. Also runs slower, and the U1 comes down to meet. Okay, so this is a logarithmic scale, so you know it might look impressive that they meet. They don't meet exactly, but you wouldn't expect them to necessarily as well, because you got some threshold corrections close to the unification scale. But the fact that they actually do indicate a grand unified scale just by supersymmetrizing the spectrum is something that you can imagine led to a lot of excitement back then. Again, the fact that the minimal versions when we went to look for photon decay are excluded means that there's some additional gap theories beyond the minimal ones that they first wrote down that are now being considered. Another thing which might be nice is that the Higgs in this framework is just one amongst many scalars. And you might say, well, you know, why is it that particular one now that gets a vacuum expectation value? And in the MSSM, it's actually the one that gets a VEV. If you run down all these parameters from a high scale, and you find that the Higgs is the one that will run negative and get a vacuum expectation value before all the other scalars, which are colored and don't couple as strongly to the things that make the Higgs run negative and get a vacuum expectation value. So this is something that is nice in the sense that, again, it's not put in by hand. It just pops out that when you supersymmetrize a spectrum, you still get that the Higgs is the one that gets a VEV. When you go beyond minimal supersymmetric extensions, like the NMSSM where you add another singlet, then it's no longer the case, and you put it as a constraint that the other scalars don't get a VEV that breaks color and so on. But in this realization and in others, it's something that that comes for free. Okay. Let me see if I've forgotten anything else. There are some things that are worse compared to the standard model. Okay, so let me write here successes. One thing that is worse is the flavor problem. Okay, so the fact that we now have all these extra colored scalars and so on lying around, and you have a lot more couplings, means that generically they would have led to effects in flavor measurements that would have already excluded them. As I said, the flavor measurements are sensitive to physics up to 100 TeV or so. And yet you want your supersymmetric partners to be at the TeV scale. So this leads to certain flavor assumptions that you need to impose on your theory. Okay, so you need to impose flavor structure in such a way that you're not killed by things like flavor changing neutral current measurements. Okay, so in the standard model, we understand very well why there's no flavor changing neutral current at tree level. Okay, they have to occur at loop level. Charge currents can occur at tree level, but not neutral currents. But for new physics, as we saw with leptoquarks, for example, that's not necessarily the case. And indeed, some of these supersymmetric partners are leptoquarks. They can couple to leptons and color at one vertex. But it turns out there's actually a natural way of doing it, which is just to impose, okay, so remember the structure of accidental symmetries that I mentioned is that you don't want to impose your global symmetries by hand, but you want them to be accidental consequences of more fundamental symmetries. And in this case, R parity is a thing that you impose, which is how you get rid of the issues with flavor. But this R parity is the kind of symmetry that you need to also stabilize a WIMP. Okay.
One question. Now that you're talking about flavor, I was thinking about Baryon asymmetry. Can you solve Baryon asymmetry with SUSY, or is it like more difficult to solve it?
It becomes easier to solve in the sense that you now have more parameters, you have more freedom for things like CP violation. Okay, so but it's not. I wouldn't class that as a success of supersymmetry in some ways. It's just that you now have more parameters to play with in which you can get things like CP violation. Okay, but you get that in any extension of the standard model.
And why, like, if you have so many extra fields, why haven't we seen them? One thing is we have one extra field, okay, we cannot see them, but it's like we just have an image of half of the world. Like.
Yeah, so welcome to 2012. That's that's essentially the perplexing question everyone was asking at the time when, even before the LHC switched on, actually, people were starting to question, why haven't we seen these things? Okay, because in the leading order expectation, the Higgs mass, remember I mentioned, was bounded by the Z mass. Okay, so if anything, you would have expected to find the Higgs and the superpartners even, you know, before the Z. So when John Ellis, you know, wrote that down his paper with Mary Gaillard and Nanopoulos in 1974 about ways in which the Higgs could show up, the lower bound at the time was something like 5 GeV or 10 GeV. And they felt like any experiments should be, that would be done in the coming decades, you know, should know how the Higgs might show up, because it could have shown up at any scale, really. Of course, this also includes loop corrections from the stops in particular that we saw. Okay. And this means that including the loop corrections, as you make the stops heavier, you can make the Higgs mass heavier than MZ, but at some point, no matter how heavy you make your stop and your other supersymmetric partners, in the MSSM, the absolute upper bound was 130 GeV. Okay, so the fact that it showed up at 125 GeV is in some ways a success as well. I mean, you could say that it's below the upper bound that's predicted in the minimal version. But as I said, if you have non-minimal versions where you add some other singlets and you can have a direct tree-level contribution to the Higgs mass, then you could have raised it above that. And there's no particular reason why the minimal version should have been the correct one. In composite models, you expect your Higgs coming from a strongly coupled sector to be on the heavier side. So people were considering Higgs bosons of a few hundred GeV up to even a TeV at the unitarity limit. And 125 GeV would have been on the lower end of what you'd expect from a composite Higgs. So as I said before, the fact that it came out at 125 GeV is almost like a very democratic way of pleasing everyone. And also another remarkable thing is that 125 GeV also maximizes the number of decay channels that the Higgs can decay into. Okay, had it been lighter or had it been heavier, then we would only have two or maybe three different channels in which to measure the Higgs. But 125 GeV is really the value that if you were an experimentalist and you said, you know, give me a standard model Higgs mass that maximizes all the different ways I can measure its decays, and that's precisely the value that someone looking out for us, you know, said, here you go. Now, why haven't we seen this yet is a good question. You know, I think the reaction to not having discovered it yet is tied to a lot of psychology in the sense that if you've been waiting for this for a long time and you're always expecting to see it at the next energy scale and the next energy scale, then naturally you get discouraged or you get disappointed or you get angry or you double down and you believe it even more fervently, you know. So all of this with a bit of distance now, I think is nice that in particular now people don't even care because they don't even, you know, study supersymmetry anymore. But let's look objectively at what is, you know, the parameter space. If we look at the WIMP parameter space, for example, even before we, as I said, all these things are fixed. Once you write down the MSSM, you supersymmetrize it, you have three parameters in terms of all the different ways in which you can put the Susy breaking terms. But the allowed region for a WIMP is about 1 TeV to 3 TeV, depending on whether you have a doublet or a triplet. So a Higgsino or a Wino, for example, the supersymmetric partner of the Higgs or of the W. And this is independent, actually, of supersymmetry, in that you could just say your WIMP is a doublet or a triplet SU2 fermion. And we've covered about, you know, this region so far. Okay. As you heard about in the other lecture, there's still the neutrino floor, which means that we could still have a WIMP being around the GeV scale. It could still be lighter at the MeV scale. But there's this whole range as well, up to about 3 TeV, where above 3 TeV, it's no longer a thermal relic, and it would no longer be a WIMP candidate. But this whole region, and this whole region is still viable. Okay. It's just that xenon 1-ton and many experiments have excluded all of this over several decades. And so as they excluded more and more of this, the excitement of a WIMP being the answer to dark matter has decreased and decreased and decreased. And the stock of axions have risen in proportion. So, you know, back when I started, axions were sort of a marginal thing that not many people were doing, but it was something we were all aware of, the QCD axion. And now it's like the thing almost everyone is doing. Okay, axions is a very hot topic of experimental searches, of theoretical model building, and there's lots of exciting things going on that side. But, you know, it's all, it's a reaction as well to the fact that we haven't discovered WIMPs, and people start to question what else is there that we could be also doing. So it's a very natural way of exploring beyond what we expect, because what we expect didn't show up at the most obvious stages. But, you know, we should remember that there's also a wide parameter space still left open. So it makes no sense to say that WIMPs are dead or similar absolutist statements like that. I wouldn't even consider them tuned in the sense that, you know, in this case, there's no argument why they had to be here and not there. So this is the parameter space to me that's still wide open. Now the stops, on the other hand, if we look at the current exclusions, they go up to about a TeV, okay? Now, remember that the tuning that we talked about the other day, if you wanted less than 10% tuning, you would have expected it to have shown up around 400 GeV, okay, which is now excluded. Now, the measurement of the Higgs mass also means that these loop corrections can't be too large. So now you have an upper bound on the stops, which depend on your other parameters, but they could be anywhere from as low as 10 TeV to, let's say, about 100 TeV. Okay. So we now have an upper bound in the MSSM on how heavy the stops can be. And the tuning would correspondingly increase. As you go above a TeV, you're starting to tune at the percent level, and at 10 TB, we're talking about a tuning at the per mil level. Okay, so now, given that the last few decades have taken us from down here up to here, your question of why haven't we seen these yet is sort of asking, why have we not seen them, given that you'd expect them, if they are tuned at less than the 10% level, they would have shown up already. How comfortable you are with a 1% tuning is a matter of taste. I think that's something which, personally, I don't find completely strange, that you have to put in parameters by hand to cancel at the percent level. But the 10 TB level is where I think you'd start to really say, OK, it's not there at all.
Do you believe in suicide?
So this leads on to maybe the last argument I want to give. Okay, which is that all of these motivations were essentially for discovering supersymmetry at the weak scale if it solves the naturalness problem and gives you WIMPs. But even before the LHC switched on, in the early 2000s, the fact that LEP hadn't even discovered it yet, and the Tevatron hadn't discovered it yet, led people to consider scenarios in which supersymmetry did not have anything to do with solving the Higgs mass problem. Okay, so one way to think about why that's motivated is that we already know the cosmological constant problem is another fine-tuning problem where there's no symmetry that protects the radiative corrections of the cosmological constant. And yet, the scale of that is at the millielectron volt, and we can't add new physics at the millielectron volt like supersymmetry to protect that. That's an even harder problem to solve, and it's still an open problem. And the fact that we may need something beyond the conventional symmetry type solutions that we've been using for understanding the Higgs mass, we might need that for the cosmological constant, leads us to think, well, maybe that mechanism could also be responsible for the Higgs mass. So maybe the Higgs mass naturalness problem is not solved by supersymmetry, but there are lots of other arguments for why supersymmetry may still exist in nature. So just like non-abelian gauge theories turned out to not be the solution to describing trying to do a theory of the SU2 isospin of protons and neutrons at the time that motivated Yang and Mills, but it turned out to be a theory of the weak force instead. So those scenarios that people considered at the time was called split supersymmetry, where you now say that maybe all the stops are indeed heavier. Okay, so this is not something that people did after the fact to try to rescue the MSSM. They were considering this already before the LHC switched on, that maybe the stops are at 10 TV, 100 TV. The only things that are required to be light to still be WIMPs are the gauginos and the neutralinos more generally. And so some of the spectrum could still be accessible at the LHC, or at a future collider. Or indeed, at a future collider, we could be sensitive to 10 TeV stops, and we may still find them there. But in a sense, that's keeping the motivation from gut unification, the successes of supersymmetry for all these other things, and a framework that could explain many other problems. But saying that it maybe has nothing to do with naturalness. And finally, I think the question of whether or not I believe supersymmetry exists or not is, for me, I think solidified by, you know, all these arguments, independently of the phenomenology, you know, do you believe in generalizing your Lie algebra in this way, is something which is nice and is a unique way in which you can extend it. But I think this totalitarian argument that I gave before of, if you see everything except one, then you're more likely to believe that one thing is there. And I think there's this beautiful paper by Benincasa and Cachazzo here at Perimeter, actually, from 07, where they make this very succinct argument for things that we already knew in other ways in more convoluted proofs in QFD. But in this case, all you need is the little group constraints on amplitudes. You don't even need a Lagrangian. And I was glad to see that you had a whole lecture series on these amplitude methods, because they are incredibly powerful for constraining what is allowed by quantum mechanics and relativity. Just the fact that things have to satisfy the little group of relativity, of Lorentz invariants, and assuming a massless and constructible theory, where by constructible, I mean that everything is determined by bootstrapping three-point amplitudes, then it turns out all the three-point amplitudes are uniquely fixed by the little group. And building up all the four-point and higher-point amplitudes in this sort of bootstrap method leads to constraints from the little group that only allows you to do this in a finite number of ways. What you find, and this is just a few pages of something a master's student can go through, you find that only spins 0, half, 1, 3 halves, and 2 are allowed, and no higher. Not only that, you find that a spin 1 can only self-interact in a particular structure, which is the non-abelian structure. You find that a spin 2 must couple universally in a way that gives the equivalence principle. And we've seen all of this except for the spin 3 halves. And the same arguments that tell you how all these other particles can consistently interact tells you that the only way a spin 3 half particle can interact is supersymmetrically. So this is an argument which is not especially convincing for many people, but you know, you could say, well, okay, there's many more possibilities. If you go to the massive case, you know, there are more theories that are not necessarily constructible in this sense. But to me, this kind of argument is already compelling from the point of view that, okay, we have such a finite possibilities for this, for massless amplitudes, and we've seen all of them except one. So I'd be very inclined to believe that a spin 3 halves has to exist in nature. And if you believe that a spin 3 halves exists in nature, then it has to be supersymmetric. So from that point of view, this kind of theoretical argument of consistency is something which is much more compelling to me than all the other sort of mathematical generalizations, in the same sense that Pauli wasn't convinced by the non-abelian generalization, because it's a nice mathematical game. But even if Einstein had never existed and Yang-Mills had never existed, and we go back a century and we just went back to Wigner and who taught us about the fact that particles are just representations of the Lorentz group, and we just took the little group constraints and we asked what are all the allowed Feynman diagrams that we can write, the allowed amplitudes that are consistent with the little group, and this tells us that we would have rediscovered the non-abelian structure, we would have rediscovered general relativity as the classical limit of a spin 2 particle, and we would have rediscovered SUSY, and we'd have experimentally gone through the discovery of all of these things except for one. Yep.
I'm like surprised by this result. I want to understand their suppositions. What would they assume? Like, they just considered quantum mechanics and relativity. Quantum mechanics is a framework. Like, with what contents? And the second question, this massless constructible thing. So they are not assuming you can construct things with 4 points.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you went through this in your lectures, but basically the spinner helicity formalism with the little group constraints that tell you how the external particles in any vertex that you write down has to be consistent, right? Is what is all the input you need. Okay, so in the quantum mechanics part is just the fact that you're talking about amplitudes, and the relativity part is just the fact that you're talking about they have to satisfy little group constraints. And then the constructible part comes from the fact that not all theories have to come from bootstrapping 3-point amplitudes. Okay, right? You could just have a quartic like that for the scalar, right? And that doesn't have to come from 2-3-point amplitudes. Okay, so there are caveats on this picture. But you know, the standard model is massless, and the standard model has all these particles. I would even add a spin 2 particle as the EFT of gravity that is part of the standard model in some ways. Okay, but it would be very strange to me that we just don't have this.
For example, a hypercharge is abelian and is spin 1 or not?
It's spin 1, yeah, abelian. So abelian and non-abelian. Yeah, sorry, I'm including. Okay. Yes. I mean that if it self-interacts, okay, you might think again that there's many different ways you can write down a spin one theory. That there's many different ways in which, you know, why do they have to have a particular non-abelian gauge structure? You can again just parameterize a vector field with lots of, I think, you know, Fokker theory. Basically, you could just write down lots of different parameterizations. But I think, to me, the little group argument is just the most direct way to get to all these facts that were known in more convoluted ways. Okay.
And do you need all your theory at high energies to be perturbative?
This is a perturbative picture in the sense that we're talking about amplitudes and how.
Because you need it to be perturbative, maybe.
Yeah.
So we need to assume that it is perturbative to be.
Well, no, this is not perturbative in the sense that we're just talking about the external particles having to satisfy a little group representation. Okay, we're not talking about Feynman diagrams in a perturbative QFT approach. We're just saying that if you have a correlation function, okay, that involves certain particles that transform on the little group in certain ways, then it doesn't matter how you calculate those correlation functions, perturbatively, non-perturbatively, okay, the answer has to satisfy the constraints that you impose on them.
So, does this mean the only way to for the three halves to self-interact is Susie?
Yes.
Okay.
To interact with all the other particles. So, in the same way that the spin two, the only way it can interact with all the others in under these assumptions is that it has to interact universally. Again, you might think in principle I could write down a Lagrangian with a spin two particle that has different couplings to different particles. Okay. But no, it has to be universal. Okay. So
it's also the softness criterion, right? The
yes, exactly.
Surviving.
Yeah.
Momentum, right?
So, you know, Weinberg's 1960s papers showed that if you have soft emission of a particle, again, this amplitude, it doesn't matter what it is, but just the soft limit of these things having to be consistent tells you conservation of charge for the spin one case, and tells you universality of the charges of the spin two case. You know, so that was a very early example of how you can bypass again QFT and Lagrangians and just require some consistency that gives you conservation of charge in a completely independent way to all the usual sort of order density and QFT type proofs. So this is sort of going back to this 50s and 60s pictures of trying to get away from QFT and proving things in a way that is as general as possible. Yep.
One would use allele group in the photon SO2. What is the allele group here?
The allele group is, for the massless case, so you make the momenta complex, okay, then you have an SU2 for the little group, and then that is the constraint that you impose, that it has to satisfy consistently the representations of that. Okay, I think it would take too long to go into the square brackets and that notation, which is basically just writing down the wild fermions in those representations. I wanted to just, well, yeah, I maybe won't have time to go into that. But I think this argument is something which is not very well known, surprisingly, in some ways. It's something that was only really appreciated in the last, decade or so. And
that I have to object to.
Well.
I think that including spin three halves was included in Weinberg's 60 papers, but then the Weinberg theorem in the 80s.
Yes.
The three thing, and so this is kind of the amplitude version of it.
Yes, exactly. But what I guess I should clarify what I meant by that is that the amplitude version of this,
right,
I think, was only, as far as I know, this is the first paper that really lays out this based purely on little group constraints. And you know, those little group constraints are incredibly powerful in the sense that the thing that really impressed me was the Park-Taylor amplitude, okay, that was written down in the 80s or 90s, I think, was this huge calculation in Feynman diagrams that collapsed into this very simple thing. And for a long time, it was very indicative that there should be some simpler way to get this. And there were many things proposed, twister methods and all kinds of things. And in the end, now anyone, a master's student in a single page, can derive that result, okay? Which in the 80s, no one would have known how to do without doing these hundreds of pages of Feynman diagram calculations on a computer that collapses into the simple result, which it was shocking to me that you just had to know about the little group and the constraints that they impose, and then you could just write down the answer. Literally just write it down and that's it. And I think what this paper showed is that it not only gives you a convenient way of writing down results, and it also constrains all the possibilities in unique ways, which reproduces what we're already known. But the fact that spin three halves has to be supersymmetric is something that was known already. But I don't think it was known in this more direct way, that it's not about which Lagrangian you write down or different ways in which you can prove it. Okay, so that answers your question. I think it was a very long way of saying that if I had to bet, I would say that supersymmetry exists at some scale in nature. I don't think it has to exist at a scale accessible to experiments, but then neither does solutions to the flavor problem, neither does solutions to the dark matter problem, neither does anything else have to be, but all we can do is to keep looking and hope that we find more hints of whatever the theory beyond the standard model is. And at some scale, I believe supersymmetry exists, so it makes sense to be aware of what the phenomenological implications of it existing at some scale might be. Because even though we only do experiments at the LHC at the TEV scale, they all play into indirect signs of what happens at the grand unified scale. If we find, for example, a QCD axion, then that is sensitive to grand unified theories in the sense that a QCD axion that comes from a grand unified theory can only exist in one part of the parameter space and not the other. So if we discover, gravitational waves from as the stochastic gravitational background tomorrow, for example, this might have implications for something that FCCEE could measure that would tell us what is directly responsible for these stochastic gravitational waves. And that might have some correlation with some version of a supersymmetric theory or not. But at the same time, I don't want to give the impression that BSM is all about supersymmetry. I think it was until the LHC. So tomorrow I'm going to go through one of the leading alternatives at the time for understanding the lightness of the Higgs, which was composite Higgs mechanisms. But the reason why it's interesting to go through composite Higgs mechanisms is that it's a whole different type of physics. The type of effective field theory that we use to describe it, using strongly coupled dynamics that confine and then lead to a low energy theory, is precisely the one of pions and kaons that that we use to describe what we already know happens. So the framework of nonlinear chiral Lagrangians is something which I'll use as an introduction to composite Higgs. And the axion is also a Goldstone boson from a new sector that spontaneously breaks. So if we have time, I'll also talk about the axion and the ways in which it's used to address naturalness problems. Okay. Thank you.